In that time, I sort of stopped calling myself an artist, and all my friends were teasing me, like, Veranda, you keep calling yourself not an artist, and then you keep doing art. But now, since I've completed these studies, now I call myself an artist again, because I think what it was I just had a narrow perception of what art is or what art could be. And then I guess I started to realize how important artistic research is for me, and now I feel very confident about saying I'm an artist.
Welcome to the latest podcast in our Arts Research Africa dialogue series. These dialogues are intended to stimulate practice, enable research, and inspire collective engagement around the question of artistic research in Africa. I'm Prof. Christa Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts. In this dialogue, I'll be speaking to Miranda Moss, a South African artist, outsider engineer, eco-geek, and rogue educator who's currently based in Sweden. Miranda's transdisciplinary practice, which focuses on the problematics and hopeful possibilities of technology from a socio-ecological and anti-colonial feminist perspective, has seen her exhibit, teach, and perform research internationally in a variety of art, science, community, academic, public, and hacker spaces. Miranda graduated with a Bachelor of Art in Fine Art with a distinction in sculpture from the Michaela School of Art, UCT, in 2012. In 2017, she was a recipient of the Pro Helvetia Artisan Labs residency, where she was stationed in a phytopathology laboratory at the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow, Forest and Landscape near Zurich, investigating the colonial weight of invasive alien microorganisms. In 2020, she was awarded the CONES Platform for Contemporary Investigative Arts Project Production Grant alongside collaborator Daniel Brunel for a work reimagining factory farming and robotics, and collaborating with agritech scientists. In 2021, she completed a master's degree in sustainable design at LNU in Sweden, where her thesis project, Power Harvest, Explorations in Regenerative Energy Technologies Within the Post-Colonial Climate Emergency, involved distilling cutting-edge scientific experiments into poetic, artistically articulated, and accessible forms of engagement. The project entailed developing a low-cost DIY system for making electricity, fertilizer, and safely treated water from human urine in response to the oppressive techno-coloniality inherent in post-apartheid South Africa's straining electrical, water, and sanitation urban grid systems. She has just embarked on a three-year-long collaborative research project titled Regenerative Energy Communities, Artistic and Collective Energy Experiments for Resilient Agriculture, funded by the Swedish Energy Agency's Program for Energy, People and Society. In this podcast, we discuss how Miranda came to art practice and her first degree in fine art at Michaelis. We also examine her engagement with scientific research and her understanding of art as a form of research. We then explore in some depth her experience as an artist based in the laboratories of the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow and Landscape in Zurich and the impact that this had on her understanding of art and research. Finally, we unpack the work she did for her MA in sustainable design and her move into the concept of regenerative energy and the potential application of this thinking in South Africa. Useful links to Miranda's website, exhibitions, awards and residencies can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Miranda, hi, welcome. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks.
And I have been following your career at a distance for the last couple of years, and I was particularly interested when I saw you got the Helvetia Artist in Residence Award and that you were in a Swiss science lab. So we'll get to that. You describe yourself as an artist, an outsider engineer, an eco-geek, and a rogue educator. So let's work out how you arrived at that. And I'm very interested in what took you into art, artistic practice, because you did do a conventional art degree at Michaelis. And your final graduation show, I see, won an award as the best graduation show of that year. So can you tell us about the path that you took?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Christo. Maybe I could speak about how I got into art in relation to how I didn't get into science and then how I did get into science. Since I was very young, I was good at drawing, so I thought I would go study art, which I think is a bit of a basic oversimplified discussion, but I think it's quite interesting now when I reflect back on it of why I didn't realize before the age 20 that I was really into ecology and into scientific practices and into technology and engineering. And a lot of these come down to gender-related issues in schooling systems. And so this is something I could really reflect on. Science and technology didn't seem like a space for me. And I was good at drawing. So, of course, I went with the thing that I got positive feedback from the schooling system and from society. This was an option. I could be a woman artist. But I have to say, I didn't see any role models to be a technologist as a 13-year-old girl. Yeah, so went to Michaelis. My artistic experience before was in drawing and painting. And then I have to say, I switched from doing painting and photography to doing sculpture. I did an elective with Jane Alexander, and I absolutely fell in love with her way of teaching, her practice. She was really an amazing mentor for me. And then I started getting into sculpture. And I'd never even held a drill before, I don't think, but I got really into like using power tools and stuff. And then again, this made me reflect on the sort of gendered situation of what practices we get into and whatnot. So this became quite important for me to explore media, which are bigger and maybe more technical and using big machines. This was really great for me. And then I kind of started getting into quite a superficial way in my final Michaelis project. I started getting into how the kind of language, material, as well as actual language of science could be used to try and describe more poetic parts of reality and also where the limitations are of scientific thinking. And so this was in quite a superficial way, but I started exploring with some electronics. I think actually I just wanted to wire up a light bulb and it exploded in my hand and it was a whole disaster. And I got a bit addicted to this thrill. And then from there, I've just been really geeking out quite hard with technology and engineering, electrical engineering and teaching myself. Although we will get to the Swiss part, but I have a community which has really been nourishing me and helping me along my process of learning. And getting into science and technology at a later age, and after studying an arts degree, which of course equips me with a lot of critical thinking, and not just taking things for granted, I find myself in a very privileged position compared to many of my colleagues or peers who studied engineering without this, and then also maybe, of course, have critical perspectives of their own, but I found this quite interesting because I thought, wow, this engineering is super cool, science is super cool, but why did it develop in the way that it did, which has just led to outrageous exploitation of the Earth and its inhabitants? Why could it not have developed differently? Is this just a sort of physical phenomena of science and technology? And so my practice that I've been developing is, no, it's not. This is one way, this is a design trajectory which came out of a colonial-powered industrial revolution and patriarchal systems. And it could have manifested in many other ways. And so let's see how else we can manifest it. And at the same time, changing those power dynamics on the way.
I've heard descriptions of your practice at this stage, coming out of your Michaelis sculpture degree, as techno-alchemy. Is that a phrase that still resonates for you? Or is it something you've moved through? What did it mean, that term?
Yeah, maybe this is a bit more in my older work. I have to say I've moved a bit away from exhibiting and more into education, like the rogue educator which you mentioned earlier. I've definitely moved more into this realm, which I guess I could describe as just working extra institutionally, like these power dynamics that was just mentioning, how these are sort of echoed within institutions. And so if you work outside of that, what does that mean? What does education mean when it's outside an institution or is rogue? Yes, but the techno-alchemy, I guess this was something thinking of how to transform things, how to transform matter and material or the way we see things, but through using like technological tools. So it has its own artifice built into the term, I guess.
It's an intriguing term. And you talk about your engagement with science, engineering. I think one could maybe distinguish between the practices of science, engineering as knowledge systems with rather different approaches towards producing knowledge, applying the knowledge. And a term I've also noticed in accounts of your work is performing research. You've talked about yourself as performing research, which is not the way I think a scientist would speak about research. They would just be doing research. Performing implies a certain distance, maybe even an ironic distance, between what you're doing and the research itself.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to the day where all scientists realize that they are performing research, that they're working within culturally defined spaces with culturally defined methodologies, that we all come with our own biases, of course, when we're looking at the world. I mean, I think it's a bit arrogant for the scientific research trajectory to possibly think that there could be such a thing as objective truth or this reductionist thinking. I think it's very dangerous and can be very damaging. And so I think it's important to think about research as performing in different spaces. Who do you perform with? These sorts of questions. Yeah, definitely a bit ironic.
So maybe let's move on to what I think has been a very significant stepping stone in your engagement with scientists and scientific practice, and that's the residency, the Artisan Lab residency you did at the Swiss Federal Institute for Forest, Snow and Landscape. And your plans, I know, when you were still preparing to go there, were to actually investigate a South African plant that has become invasive in Europe. I mean, we're so used to invasive plants here from other parts of the world, which have, you know, completely transformed the South African landscapes. Tell us about the experience of entering a lab, that particular lab, and how your ideas about your research changed through that engagement.
I guess I applied to the regular Prohovitzia residency program, which I absolutely recommend any young artist to definitely apply. It's a very interesting experience. And I applied with this project looking into this particular plant, Senecio inequidens, if I'm going to use the Nayan term, which I hesitate to do so, which has a very interesting history. And this plant, they look a bit like dandelions, but the wing seeds contaminated, as they're called by the Western scientists, contaminated wool exports. And as we know, when South Africa was colonized, large parts of land were designated for farming sheep to supply European trade. And so these winged seeds got in the sheep's wool and then got taken back to Europe. That's all nice and well, but now because of global warming, the seeds have actually started to become an issue. And the terminology that's used around these plants by botanists and scientists and ecologists are really very similar words referring to people and migration, especially in the global south. So I thought this was a bit ironic, you know, that the Europeans come to South Africa and steal the land, steal the people. But then when it becomes an issue for them, then it's, oh, no, this is not okay that our land has been colonized by an African plant. You know, then this becomes the issue. And so then more borders are put up, so reinforcing this uncomfortable power dynamic again between Europe and Africa. So I thought this was a really interesting kind of starting point, and I wanted to look into this plant in more detail, as well as the cultures surrounding so-called invasive species. And then after Prohovitzia received my application, they had actually been wanting to do a trial run with Prohovitzia South Africa collaborating with Artisan Labs, which is a Swiss project where they do exactly that. They place artists in laboratories for residencies. So that when they read my application, they thought, okay, cool, this would be a match. But then, as I said before, I was still working with science in quite a superficial way. And I don't mean superficial in a negative sense, just in a more aesthetic sense, should we say, the language. Yeah, so they placed me in the Swiss Federal Institute for Snow, Forest and Landscape, and specifically in a phytopathology laboratory. And phytopathology basically just means things that kill plants. And so we're looking at a lot of naughty organisms that eat plants. But again, many, many really interesting culturally embedded stories. And then I got really into this one fungus that quite a few researchers were looking at. And it turned out that it was actually brought to Cape Town with possibly the first orange tree. And another one of these stories of how impacts of colonialism only show themselves later or are amplified later, or how insidious these effects are. So as we know, that Jan van Riebeek came and planted some orange trees, which set off the colonial expansion of South Africa, and to provide, of course, sailors coming around the Cape with nutrients so they don't get scurvy. And on one of these orange trees, it's estimated or guessed that it had this fungus on it. And this fungus basically eats woody plants. And now what that means now, that several hundred years on, this fungus has actually been contained in the company gardens because of the roads, because just of the layout of the city. But now it's actually spread to Table Mountain and it's spread to Kirstenbosch. And as we know, the Western Cape is one of the biodiversity hotspots of the world, which is an amazing treasure that needs to be protected. But now this fungus, this colonial legacy, which even has been referred to as Van Riebeek's curse in the 90s when the scientists in South Africa found this, is now really putting danger onto woody fynbos. And what do we do about it? I'm not sure, but I mean, I guess it brings up questions of responsibility, of reparations, of how to heal the land and its inhabitants simultaneously. Sorry, that was my backstory. And now how it was to walk into the lab. Yes, so I guess first walking into the lab was very sterile and clean. I have some hilarious photos of me. I got given a desk next to the other scientists. And there are these hilarious photos of my desk versus the scientist's desk. It's just like piles of of stuff. It was a bit awkward. I didn't really know how to break in. And I think the scientists also struggled with how to really interface with me. But there were some who were super lovely and took a lot of time to teach me things, to explain their practice, which was really nice. And I guess I just took the strategy of going and speaking to everyone and being super friendly and asking them about what they do. And then trying to practically intervene where I could, which I still struggled with. I struggled to do this. But something that I did notice, which was interesting, after being this super friendly, strange artist who came into their lab, is I became a bit of a matchmaker, both in terms of research and in terms of love. So somehow after my residency, there were like three new romantic relationships. It was so bizarre. But this was just because I was talking to people and like, oh, you know, this person, they're also doing that. And it was quite interesting, again, thinking about the reductionism of the scientific method, is that some people were working on this part of a plant, like the roots, and other people were working on the leaves. And there were one person was stuck with something to do with the leaves. And then I spoke to someone else and they're busy working on this with the roots. And I'm like, oh, have you spoken to the person at the end of the corridor? They're busy working on this with roots. And they're like, oh, yes, I should speak to them. So that was quite interesting, like how an artist can bring a more smooth social collaboration between the scientists. But I think all of us were a bit, what exactly am I doing here? But I think that's an okay feeling. But what was really meaningful was at this time, I happened to meet these societies, these communities that I was mentioning earlier. So the Swiss Mechatronic Art Society and the International Hacteria Society. The mechatronics, this is more focused on electronics, and the hacteria is more focused on biology and biohacking. And both of these have been very important for me. I mean, for me, I don't see a separation in the practices, but these are these two societies that I kind of accidentally met in Switzerland. And then this was very interesting to have this institutional scientific sort of cornerstone, and then at the same time working with these rogue hackers as well. And they really built my practical confidence, or helped to build my practical confidence with regards to feeling as though I do actually have something to say in a research format, or my knowledge as an artist is valid as in a scientific realm or in a engineering realm, and that maybe this criticality that I have from before is maybe even preferable to be included in sort of science and technology.
Can I take you back to when you started in the lab? What was the expectation amongst the scientists, or maybe just in the mind of the director of the lab, because presumably the director had okayed your residency? Did you have discussion with that person about what they imagined you were going to do, what they anticipated you would bring to the lab?
So what's particular about this lab is that they have worked with artists in labs before. So they have had a few collaborations, and they know that contemporary art doesn't just mean making nice pictures of my scientific data, which I think is firstly an issue which comes up quite often, or something that I have noticed with collaborating with engineers and scientists who haven't collaborated with artists before. They definitely can be, not all people, but there is a tendency to expect what kind of practice it might be. And you sort of get put into this box, which is a bit disempowering. But I have to say that us in the creative side need to be careful to not do this with engineers and scientists as well. So yeah, I felt really privileged that they were very open. They had been working with a few different artists before, one on a very open-ended research residency, and then another longer-term collaboration with some artists who were actually involved in this one of these societies I was talking about. So that was really nice. They were really open-ended, but maybe it was even too open-ended. So there weren't particularly expectations from them. But I think it would have been nice if there was a bit more of a kind of guidance or program to guide this kind of interface. This becomes tricky, of course, because everyone's really busy always. So how to do this in a way that allows for something beneficial on both sides and seeing as something that is important to spend time on.
You weren't actively involved in the lab meetings and report backs, the cycle of official sociability in the lab? Were you just given a desk and left to do things?
Kind of, yeah. I was kind of given a desk and left to do things. Of course, people were very friendly and checked in on me, but I sort of had to choose my own adventure, which I did with trying to speak to a lot of people and sort of find things to follow. So there wasn't a particular program. I did go to a few kind of meetings, and I went to one of the researchers' PhD defense, which was actually super, super interesting. But I did spend quite a lot of time, I sort of huddled together with the witches of the lab. There was an amazing technician, Helen, and I actually helped her quite a lot with preparing the agar plates and stuff like this. So I also learned a lot from her, and also a PhD student who I became friends with. So that was nice. I got really into working in the lab, as well as helping them, as well as having conversations as we went. So that was quite a nice format, but I wasn't expecting to be doing this, no.
Can you tell us about this amazing PhD defense that you audited, and what was amazing about it for you as an artist in that lab?
Firstly, it was a PhD on this fungus that I was interested in. And so this researcher had been helping me a lot to work with this fungus and introducing me to its existence to start off with. And then it happened to be her PhD defense while I was in the residency there, which was great to go to. So firstly, I was interested in the content, and it was very technical and very specific. And then what was quite interesting, then they have this panel of examiners, and they all asked very specific questions like, on page 4, I see that the experiment, you actually autoclaved the wood before, but do you think autoclaving could have an effect on the way that the fungus grows in the chamber at how many degrees Celsius, blah, blah, blah. And they were all sort of asking her questions like this. And then the last invigilator, he said, I have one question for you, I guess. What is a fungus? And what was really interesting is the whole room is full of mycology specialists from Europe. I mean, a lot of people came to this from phytopathology, but also mycology. And all of these specialists from Central Europe are in this room. And as soon as this invigilator asked the question, what is a fungus? Everyone just went, like, you can't ask a question like that. And everyone got really uncomfortable, because we can go down to these super specific things, right? But like, what is it actually? You know, and I think this is something that we see a lot. We can explain all sorts of details, but we don't actually know exactly what life is. Sometimes we have a definition for life, and then it gets refuted by thinking about viruses again or whatever. So these really core things about what exactly is going on in reality are quite thinly understood, I guess, sometimes.
Or there's a unstated, unconscious, practical knowing that these scientists are all within. And asking that question, you know, what is it, immediately breaks that comfortable but unexamined consensus that I've heard the same with biology labs. Yeah, we're asking, what is life? And nobody ever has to answer that question to do very specialized research in biology, for instance. But when the question's asked, it immediately upsets things. It throws them. And in terms of the practice that you developed in that time during that residency, what did you do in your practice to respond to these questions, this research that was going on there?
So I would say it was really a research residency, which was wonderful that Provitzia gives this opportunity to have such an open-ended residency. But I did want to do a little show at the end. And there was expectation to do a presentation, which could be seen in many ways. But I did a little exhibition, which showed a lot of my research work, including just a huge amount of notes, for instance, and all these funny stories that I'd collected, all these sort of little details that I'd noticed, for instance, like this, what is a fungus? But I was constantly doing these kind of iterations. I mean, this was 2017. And so I also took it upon myself to get in touch with Nestlé about their kind of awful water extraction and land usage practices, corporate practices, because I was in Switzerland. And I was like, Nestlé's in Switzerland. I should get in touch. I guess this came from a bit of a socio-cultural shock of just seeing how the urban spaces are designed. And the kind of decadence of water, for instance, like in the streets in Switzerland, they have all these fountains with water just kind of like elegantly being thrown around. And this was a bit of a shock coming from the drought in Cape Town and then all of a sudden coming to Switzerland and being like, what? This is really uncomfortable. This makes me so uncomfortable. And so also looking into things like water, which also fed into my work at the lab. Then with this electronic society, I also started going to their weekly meetups and starting to work on some electronics to listen to plants and started making a prototype for an underground radio station out of mycelium, which the scientists were also quite interested in because they said this would be really nice. Instead of having to genetically sequence the mushrooms, they could just listen to them. And then they can just hear if it's the same organism or a different organism. Again, the idea of an organism, this is something that shifted a lot when I was in the lab working with these mushrooms. Again, we really inflict our kind of anthropocentric view on the world, but the idea of a single organism, I don't have that idea anymore at all.
So it was really a very open-ended opportunity just to explore.
Yeah.
How long was the residency?
3 months.
Oh, 3 months. It was quite a short one. Do you think 3 months was long enough to really get into the work of the lab?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not sure if the intention was for me to get into the work of the lab. I think it was maybe more of a kind of starting off exchange. For me, at that time, I think it was a good amount. But now I want to go and do a nine-month research residency at a lab. I think maybe I would have been overwhelmed. I didn't feel so confident in those sorts of spaces yet. But at the same time, this was really integral to me growing into feeling comfortable going to labs. I'm actually in a lab right now. So I just keep going back to labs.
You guessed it from the bright, almost farthest backdrop.
Yeah, it's an art and science lab. So this is something I found that exists, which is super lovely, is that there are a lot of creative rogue scientific labs, technology labs, and I feel pretty comfortable in this space. And I feel pretty comfortable now, I guess because of this experience, but also with these societies, staying in touch with these societies, which has been a really lasting impact on my practice. We still collaborate a lot, but feeling comfortable to be a translator, I guess, in some way. I think maybe I really like learning these sort of technical things. And I think it helps for me to be a translator in some ways between different disciplines. So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate my position as an artist to really transgress disciplinary kind of confines. And I think that's something that we really have as artists. It's quite a superpower and we need to not forget it. I know it's easy in like a kind of techno-obsessed, Silicon Valley-obsessed world. We can forget the kind of powers we have as artists and cultural workers. And I think it's really important to be confident.
That's good. And after that residency, a couple of years subsequent, you actually went on to do MA in sustainable design at the Swedish, the Linnaeus University. I mean, that's a name that must have a lot of resonance for you as somebody interested in Cape and Cape flora. I mean, Linnaeus spent a lot of time in the Cape, didn't he? Developing his vast taxonomy of plant life. And what attracted you to this MA and what came out of it for you? What did you learn and where did it take you?
Yeah, the Linnaeus, I don't know why in 2010 they decided to name a university after Linnaeus. I don't know if you noticed, but I call the university LNU usually. Yeah, because I don't think Linnaeus needs any more screen time. So it was in a bit of a quarter life crisis, I guess. What am I doing? Also feeling in Cape Town that I wasn't being pushed enough in a research sense. and feeling a bit, ooh, what am I doing? Feeling like the stages for artistic research or artistic practice were largely centered around commercial platforms, and that was not so interesting for me, or not wanting to make work which fits in that space, and then also maybe getting a bit tired of, like, we were organizing quite a lot of pop-up project spaces and stuff, and then after a while you get a bit tired of doing this and pass it on to the next generation kind of thing, and really wanting to learn a lot more, really questioning my own artistic practice in light of the climate emergency, as well as the situation in South Africa sociopolitically, as well as a kind of rage or a discomfort of how the society is in South Africa. That being said, I didn't leave because I felt this rage. I felt I needed some distance and then to come back, which I'm really hoping to do. But I'm feeling very privileged that I can do the research that I can do and get paid for it at this moment, which is super amazing. And then, yeah, hopefully bring it back. This is the plan. So studying sustainable design, it was also a very quick decision, sort of web search, sustainable design master program. I was thinking, yeah, studying, this is something I've done before. I guess I can do it again. Yeah, I guess in Cape Town, also just doing a lot of odd jobs to make ends meet and thinking, hey, it would be super cool to do something more focused again. And also wanting to get a bit out of the space of art. And then in that time, I sort of stopped calling myself an artist. And all my friends were teasing me, like, Veranda, you keep calling yourself not an artist and then you keep doing art. But now, since I've completed these studies, now I call myself an artist again, because I think what it was I just had a narrow perception of what art is or what art could be. And I felt that art existed in particular platforms, which I also wasn't comfortable with, like very exclusive platforms. And then I guess I started to realize how important artistic research is for me. And now I feel very confident about saying I'm an artist again, as opposed to a sustainable designer.
And apart from rediscovering yourself as an artist, what did you learn on the Masters in Sustainable Design?
Yeah, it's a really interesting program. I'm teaching in it now as well, and also coordinating the Masters program. And this is a two-year program with a six-month final project at the end. So it's a bit different to how I was used to thinking about Masters programs, I guess, from Michaelis, which is like a two-year project, right? Is that how it works at WITS as well?
Yeah, it is.
So it's, I guess, a year and a half of courses. And these were mostly kind of socio-ecological sustainability, so where the social aspect is very, very important. When I went there, I guess I had an idea of what sustainable design would be like at a university. And I guess, again, this would have been very instrumentalist, maybe a lot more technical, sort of thinking of technical solutions to climate issues. But it turned out it was a lot more kind of critical design, norm-creative design practices, as well as transdisciplinary design was another course that we did. And then for the six-month final project, actually for the last year, I got really into thinking about energy, and particularly from the situation in Cape Town, where energy, water, and sanitation are so bound up, and who has access and who doesn't have access becomes quite intersectional. I started developing these low-cost, open-source DIY microbial fuel cells, where you can make electricity from electroactive bacteria in urine. So I was thinking, how can we actually work with living ecosystems? Or maybe another way to put it is, how can we get electricity in a way that is inherently non-extractivist in its design? So in this case, you would have to care for an ecosystem, as well as where other services are being provided. So where the energy production is actually, you can sort of situate as a beneficial waste product, maybe. But actually, the main service you are providing is wastewater treatment, sanitation facilities, as well as fertilizer for agriculture. And then you also get electricity from this. So yeah, this is what I was working on. I mean, I'm still working on it, but I'm quite, so I had the time to experiment with this and also look at it from a lot of different views. When I was there in Sweden, something that was quite significant for me was I started working with this experimental farming collective, and I totally fell into their ideals and their practices super quickly. It was a second home for me, I guess, working on this farm as a volunteer and just a comrade. And that really made me question my sort of, again, my obsession with electronics. So these farmers, they call themselves regenerative farmers, where sustainability is seen as not enough, I guess. So not just wanting to sustain things as how they are indefinitely, but actually to improve the damage that has been done to socio-ecological systems. And so with their farming practices, this could look like, of course, no pesticide use, organic, no synthetic fertilizers, but then also not just planting for human consumption, but planting for pollinators, planting for improving ecosystems, reintroducing native species into the ecosystems, etc., improving water quality. And I was really thinking, how can I think about my technical practice in this way? Like, I absolutely agree with all of these principles. Like, this is great. How can I think about electronics and how can I think about energy that I'm so into? How can I think about it in this way, which obviously makes total sense on principle? And the answer is like, I can't. So I'm like, okay, I need to shift my practice into a space where I can. And this is a bit impossible. I mean, they have principles like only collect materials which come from 6 kilometer radius of where they are. So it really stays within the ecosystem. Okay, so how can I think of making a smartphone where all the materials come from 6 kilometers? And then, of course, thinking about where it goes afterwards. And as we know, just e-waste, the mining, as well as the dumping of e-waste, this, again, is another colonial issue and a very uncomfortable power dynamic between Europe and Africa specifically, but also other continents and countries. But so really looking at this relationship, what would this mean if we had a totally redefined sort of basic principles for developing electronics and thinking about energy?
And this has led into your post-MA collaborative project on regenerative energy. And how's that working?
It's been a really amazing project. So this was quite wild. While I was finishing my MA with some other staff at the university, we started talking about energy-related things and having really lovely conversations. And we put together a funding proposal for the Swedish Energy Agency. And then we got it, which is amazing. And that's allowed us to part-time work on this project for the last 2.5 years, which has been totally amazing. But always nagging at my sleeve is like, okay, when do we go back to South Africa to work on this there? I have to say, my final master's exhibition actually took place in Johannesburg. I displayed my work, not in Sweden, but part of an exhibition that Carly Whittaker was curating, which was really super. So this research project, it's been really amazing. I guess when we started, even though we had quite this radical proposition, with my colleagues Eric, Daniel, and Helen, we had this quite radical proposition. But I still thought we would be kind of erecting energy infrastructure on this farm, right? Like using these regenerative farming principles and applying them to thinking about energy, this regenerative energy concept.
And just spell out those principles, because you mentioned one was gathering materials to 6 kilometers from where you based. What were the other principles?
Yeah, our project had a little patch of land on this experimental farm where there are a few different projects going on. And when we got the contract, it said, if your plants can't eat it, don't bring it onto the site. But they said within reason. I mean, yes, they use watering cans and things like this, but it's just something to think about, you know? And then I start thinking, okay, so this energy infrastructure, yeah, why would I make anything that a plant can't eat? Like, why would I do that? But then when you start thinking about electronics, this gets a bit tricky. But since then, it's turned into kind of bioelectronics realm, growing onions whose membranes have nanostructures which can be used as piezoelectric nanogenerators, and continuing with the electroactive microorganisms which can grow conductive biofilms, this kind of thing. But that's super geeky. Anyway, but I guess in a more grounded sense, this is something that we set out maybe quite early in the project of what regenerative means to us. For we had to focus a bit for this project, but how can everything come back to the soil? So how can everything be grounded in the soil? How can we think of energy infrastructure that improves soil health? So for one was making science equipment out of things we grew, for instance, growing beetroot and making pH sensors to test the quality of the soil, also growing calabash and gourd squash for replacing plastic parts of electronics. Also just working seasonally. I think this is really amazing when you're growing things for your practice, for your technological practice. You have to really think in seasons and your design has to think in seasons. And I think this is super lovely, not just like produce, 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 you know, and really working with plants, designing with the plants, which is to hopefully make a greater ecosystem. And when I say ecosystem, I don't just mean like an ecological ecosystem, but also the social dynamics at play. And this is all really important.
So clearly, a highly developed society economy like Sweden offers lots of support for this kind of endeavor, this sort of experimentation and exploration. What is the applicability of this back here in South Africa, where people are living with impossibly high levels of unemployment, of huge material inequalities in how they live, where they live? Is this not a very privileged global northern bubble that allows this kind of exploration? Does it have relevance to us here in Africa, and how?
Now the podcast starts. Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something I've been grappling with a lot while I've been in Europe and feeling quite uncomfortable about this all the time on the phone to my mother. Like, oh, now we have 8 hours of load shedding a day. How's the energy project coming along, Miranda? And I'm like, sorry, I just made nano generators out of onion skins. It's not particularly useful to power your lights. Sorry. So this has been something which has been conflicting in me, but I think it's also a useful conflict. I think that we cannot just add to what we have. We really need total paradigm shifts underlying our energy and other municipal infrastructure. I'm not an engineer. I'm not going to pretend to be an engineer. So I cannot solve these issues. But what I do think we need is innovation that comes from communities being empowered at the core of the land and social and economic systems being regenerated at the core, ultimately for power redistribution, but power in both senses, like the redistribution of power in both senses. So I'm working a lot now, and it's been weird working in the Swedish context because I'm always working for South Africa in my brain, in my soul. It's a duty for me. I see it as a duty. And it's quite interesting to see how in Sweden, I mean, honestly, we were also surprised that we got funded by the Swedish Energy Agency for such an open artistic project as well. Most of the other projects they funded were sort of modeling of smart cities. But I think what this tells us is that there is, from one of the most energy privileged nations in the world, which has this kind of high sustainability ranking, that there is a need for a total shift of thinking and underlying imagination. I think, as my colleague Eric says, we have a crisis of imagination, thinking about energy futures. And so I'm very happy and very privileged that we receive funding to do this work. I also think that, again, I feel as though I can act as a translator. I look kind of Swedish, and it's always very surprising for people when I'm not. But I think it's also a duty to tell privileged nations that this is their job. They fucked up the world, and they actually need to fix it in this way. So I do see sustainability, I guess, or sustainable practices. I think this intersects with many other inequalities issues, and that this does need to be confronted everywhere in the world. Like, I don't like to use the term Anthropocene, because it kind of denotes the whole of humankind has made this scene. But if we look again at the trajectory of science, of technology, of the Industrial Revolution, of colonial narratives, we come to actually quite a small group of people and this kind of small market which has exploded into a global situation and which has resulted in a climate crisis as well. So I do also feel that the global north needs to put in a lot of work into making things right again.
And you being in the global north, having this space and funding to experiment, to stimulate imagination about different energy futures, is one of the ways that the global north can make recompense for the catastrophic effects of colonialism, of climate change. Do you see yourself coming back to South Africa with lessons learnt in Sweden, lessons learnt through this kind of project around regenerative energy?
Yeah, I hope so. My plan was to steal the time and not steal, no, take the time and education and resources and redivert them in ways. It's really interesting. The city that I'm in is Europe's greenest city, apparently, but they have very interesting energy systems which have just been implemented in the municipality for decades already, sort of pre-climate crisis thinking. And so this has been an interesting site to work with at this time, which also saw I think on one day it was 1,000% increase in the price of electricity in where I am in Sweden after the Ukraine war started. So then there's also been an energy crisis in Europe at this time of us doing the project. And I mean, I see myself as just maybe the like anti-colonial feminist killjoy, just reminding everyone. Everyone's talking about the energy crisis. And I'm like, can you please specify which energy crisis you're referring to? I also grew up in an energy crisis. What's so special about your European energy crisis? But that being said, as I said, I feel a strong duty to South Africa. I'm getting really antsy about when to come back and how to come back and where to go from there. So also, if anyone who's listening to this wants to collaborate, or if you can know of any friends who are doing any community energy and agriculture or energy justice projects, I would be super happy to be involved or offer what I can, technical expertise, which I have a bit of. So this is really important for me to come back and work.
Miranda, I think that's a great point for us to end. And hopefully the word does get out to our listeners and the kind of skills and I think amazing reconception about energy in relation to sustainability and regeneration really does have application here in South Africa. And the absolute collapse of infrastructure, water, sewage, electricity that we're all living in, might even provide the ground for an openness to new, entirely new approaches, which you certainly are experimenting with up there in Sweden.
Thanks, Christo.
So thank you very much for the time. And in the show notes, I'll put links to the projects that you've been involved with, and particularly your latest project, this regenerative energy project. And hopefully word gets out and more connections are made, and we hope to see you back here in South Africa.
Thanks. Something we're working on at the moment, a bit of a side project, is running an internet server off of homegrown wind turbines made from mycelium. So you can like grow your own turbines and from e-waste motors. And I'm busy designing the charge circuit as we speak. And so hopefully actually coming to South Africa to do some workshops at the end of the year.
That'd be amazing. We look out for that and we'll stay in touch. Thanks very much, Miranda.
Thanks, Christo. Thanks for the chat.
You've been listening to a dialogue between myself, Christo Doherty, the Chair of Research in the Wits School of Arts, and my guest, the South African artist, outsider engineer, eco-geek and rogue educator, Miranda Moss. This podcast was hosted and produced by myself, with technical production by Elna Schutz. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Lee Rosevere and is used under a Creative Commons license.